First question was about the role of Christian Zionism and how important it is. I'm glad you mentioned it. And the book I co-authored with Chomsky, I have a chapter on the history of American support for Israel, and I highlight the importance of Christian Zionism on both sides of the Atlantic ever since the early 19th century, both in the conception of Zionism as a colonialist movement that regarded Palestine as its homeland, whereas there were other options. This was very much under Protestant Christian Zionist influenced, and also its present impact on policy. So I think, yes, Christian Zionism is definitely a strong force in, it's a kind of a third leg in a leg in a triangle that gives Americans unconditional American support to Israel, together with AIPAC and the military-industrial complex. But we may come back to this issue with other questions in mind. Is the Jewish state, is this Judaism based on ethnicity or based on religion? I think that it's ethnicity. I think there is an ethnic organic Jewish group now in Israel, few millions, an equal number of Palestinians who live between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. So the Jewish state is a state that gives a preference and a first citizen status to anyone who is considered ethnically, not only religiously, Jewish. It's an ethnocracy, as some of the Israeli new sociologists like to call it. So it's not a democracy, it's a state which gives preference in all walks of life to one ethnic group, which happens to be a third generation of settlers, over the indigenous native population of Palestine. Steps toward the future. I'm very hopeful. I don't know why. Maybe it's my tiredness. I've been all over Canada. I'm very hopeful. I've never been as hopeful as I am today. I'm serious. And the reasons I don't give a map, my roadmap, what does it matter? I mean, I'm a professor from the University of Exeter. I'm not a leader, I'm not a state, I'm not in administration, I'm not even a movement. Maybe half a movement of the new historians. But the other half became so fanatic that maybe I'm the only movement. I don't know. It doesn't matter. But what is important is that there is a division of labor that can give us an idea of how we move from here to the other, to a better future. And the division of labor is important, not the steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, of an individual. Only prophets give 10 points and ask the people to follow them. I'm not a prophet. I'm hardly an historian. I'm definitely not a prophet. But I think there is a division of labor, and I want to be part of that division of labor towards the future. The Palestinians have to get their act together. They know it. They haven't solved the issue of representation for years now. We need the Palestinian unity. We need the Palestinian representation. We need to know who are we talking to when we talk about the Palestinian political leaders. We don't know yet. It's because of the fragmentation that happened on the ground. So without Palestinians solving the issue of representation, it's very hard to move forward. So that's one thing. And I can't go to the Palestinians and say to them, solve your issue of representation. I can say it, but it doesn't matter. Now, on the ground in Israel and Palestine, we have to start, and some of us have started, a very huge project of re-education, engaging with the Israeli fear, which is both manipulated and genuine, engaging with all everyone who lives there, and rebuilding trust between people who used to think that their ethnic group is everything and all the rest are nothing. This is a huge project, and I've been involved in this for 25 years, but I hope to see many more people involved in this. But the one effort does not exclude the other. All these efforts have to go together. And thirdly, you in the West have a very important role to play. Contrary to what you think, it's not so much the role of bringing the two sides together. You can still do it if you want. It's okay. I like Vancouver. If you want me to meet my Palestinian friends here, I'll come any day. But we need you to stop the destruction on the ground by supporting boycott, divestment, and sanction against the state of Israel. We need this pressure from the outside in order that there will be a chance from the inside, and in order that Palestinians and Jews alike eventually would build something else. Because one of the reasons I think people don't talk that much of the next steps is that actually we have one state in Palestine. There is already one state. There's one regime that controls everything between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. In it, there are Palestinians who live in conditions which are far better than were in apartheid South Africa. And in it are Palestinians who live in conditions which are far worse than ever Africans have experienced in apartheid South Africa. Now, we need to change that regime, and I'm not offering changing that regime the way Americans change regimes. I don't want you to bomb Tel Aviv, but I have too many friends there. But I do think we have to think about an evolutionary way of changing it, and I know that the vast majority of the Jews in Israel don't want it. Don't think I'm naive. I'm coming from there. I know what kind of government Israel is going to elect in September 2012. But that's not the point. The point is that you can, with clean hands, say to Israelis and Palestinians that the idea of equal rights, equal civil rights, equal individual and human rights is something that the 21st century demands from every society. As for the right of return, I think that because it was so much excluded, a lot of issues concerned to the right of return have been left aside and not dealt with. And there are a few principles that I think are very important about the right of return without even yet understanding maybe how exactly or fully we'll implement it. One principle is that this is an individual right, internationally recognized by the United Nations. So it doesn't matter if a Palestinian leader is giving it up. It doesn't matter if Israel doesn't accept it. This is an internationally recognized individual right of every Palestinian refugee, and it will remain so, despite everything anybody would do. So this is something to take into account if you want to move on with a solution that doesn't respect the most basic right of people to come back to their homes. This will not be a solution. This would be managing a conflict on one of these terms that political scientists in America use in order to produce 10 articles a year which are needed for their promotion. But this has nothing to do with what solutions in real life are. The second thing about the right of return, which is very important, is to understand the Israeli refusal for the right of return. This has nothing to do with capacity. This has nothing to do with demographics as such. This has to do with racism. And my best friends, and I say this with all my heart because these are my best friends, among the most leftist in Israel, including your friend Uri Avneri, when they are honest enough, they tell you that their greatest fear is to live in a place where the Jews are not a majority. And I respect those at least who say it openly. I don't like liberal Zionists as a rule, because they think the same, but they don't say it. So they say, we'll give up the West Bank so that we could be racist only in 80% of Palestine. This is merit. This is Gush Shalom, unfortunately. I say, no. Either you think, and that's your right, but you will pay the price for this, that you are entitled in the 21st century to have an ethnic state which will use every means possible to remain ethnically Jewish, both demographically and geographically. It's okay, but don't then also ask to be a member in the club of democracies. You cannot be the only democracy in the Middle East and a racist ethnic state. It doesn't work. You can be one or the other. That's all. How many Palestinian refugees would want to return, we have no idea. We have no idea. We have no idea how many people would want to come and visit, how many people would want to have a second house there, how many people would want to build their house there. We can discuss all these issues only, but only after we acknowledge this as a sacred right, And we don't use the demographic argument that if there will be too many Palestinians, there will be not a Jewish state. If this is the argument you want to use, it doesn't matter how many refugees you are willing to accept. So just don't accept anyone. But we have to be open about it. Israel, as a society, has to make a choice between two options and stop squaring the circle. You know, again, liberal Zionism is a bit like Diet Coke and decaffeinated coffee. You see, I've been here a week. I've tried all your gastronomic inventions. I was not impressed, I must say. Now, Uri Avneri says that we will be, supporting BDS, people like him will be more entrenched, more demonized by the Israeli society. I don't think it's true, by the way. I think the facts show exactly the opposite. The facts show that since the BDS campaign has started, two things have happened. The Israeli society, for the first time, returned to discuss the occupation because of the BDS. It's much better than what caused it to discuss the occupation in 2002. You know what caused the Israeli society to discuss the occupation in 2002? Suicide bombs. I prefer BDS to suicide bombs. The second thing, which is not true, is that then liberal Zionism is shrinking. He's right. But it is replaced by anti-Zionism. There's a new generation of anti-Zionist Jews in Israel, which people like Uri Avneri find difficult to accept and digest. But this is the new Israeli left. The new Israeli left does not differentiate between Palestinians in Haifa and Palestinians in Nablus. And Palestinians in the Yarmouk refugee camp. They don't. They are a minority, don't misunderstand me. They are a minority, but they are a third generation Israelis, and they have a chance. They have a chance of changing Israel from within. I believe in them. I'm an historian. I have a very long span of, I look at history as something very long. I'm not impressed by activists who tell me they've been 2 years in this business and nothing happened. I said to them, good morning. I've been 50 years and nothing happened. So what? I always tell my children, when you become an activist, you don't ask yourself how much have I achieved, but how much did I do yesterday? That's the only question you ask. You don't try to collect dividends. This is for politicians from above. This is not for real people. Finally, I think you asked about losing hope. Well, I think I answered it, but let me just repeat it. I'm very hopeful. If you say that eventually there will be no Israel, I don't see it that way. I never accepted this accusation that, you know, people said to me, you don't recognize the right of Israel to exist. I said, how can I as an individual not recognize a right of a state to exist? What am I, a United Nations, the International Court of Justice? I'm a human being, I'm hardly that even. So how can I not recognize? Of course I can only recognize the state. I cannot not recognize it. It's there, believe me, I know it. I know it is there. The question is, what are your hopes for? If your hopes are for an Israeli Jewish state, then yes, I think this may change in the future. I don't know. It makes me hopeful if this is going to change. I want to live in a place, to be frank, and that's also about the right of return. I want to live with my friend Mahmoud Diazbak in Nazareth, with whom I have much more in common than my cousin in Vancouver, and I think I have one. Maybe he's here, I don't know. Are you here? No. Whom I've never met. I have no wish to see him in Israel. I hope he has no wish to come to Israel. I want to share the future with Mahmoud in Nazareth, not with Chaim from Vancouver. That's my future. And that's the future, I think, for most people who live in Israel. That doesn't mean that Jews should not continue to come if they want to immigrate to Israel, and refugees should return to Israel. We can have space for everyone there. It's when we start to exclude people on the basis of race, ethnicity, and religion that we create abominations and evil systems that eventually would collapse whether we recognize them or not. Zionism as a movement was born out of two very noble impulses. There's nothing wrong with that. The wish to found a secure place for Jews in a very dangerous Europe in the mid and late 19th century, and one should respect the wish to to survive, especially when one knows what happened to the Jews later on. And the second noble and acceptable impulse was to redefine Judaism as a national movement, as everybody else did in the late 19th century. There was nothing problematic, I think, with that. The problem with Zionism was when it decided that Palestine is the territory, for obvious reasons, but the moment Palestine was chosen as the territory in which to satisfy these two impulses of security and identity, the moment they chose Palestine, Zionism became a settler colonialist project and remained so until this very day. Now, I think what should make it easier for us to discuss these issues without falling into unnecessary demonizations and descriptions is to understand that it's not the only settler colonialist movement in the world. Not far away from here, about 5 meters from here, there is a nation that also was born as a settler colonialist nation. And sometimes when you genocide the native people, you have less problems than when you just ethnically cleanse them. And I think that the problem with Zionism is that it's a 21st century settler colonialist movement. That's why we find it so difficult. Not because the story is complex. The story is not complex. Europeans left Europe for all kinds of reasons, settled in non-European countries. Usually they either genocide or colonize the local people. In no case in history did they offer them peace, prosperity, and joint life. There isn't such a chapter in colonialism. There isn't. What we need is the Israeli Jewish society, first of all, to acknowledge that it is a settler colonialist society. And then go for the complex issue. The complex issue is how you decolonize settler colonialist society. That's not easy. And to say to themselves, we are lucky, we are not as bad as people who genocide the people. We didn't genocide the Palestinians. So there's still hope. There's still chance. As the whites, probably most of them still don't believe that they did the right thing, but eventually were forced to decolonize apartheid South Africa. Therefore, I'm not impressed with the term Zionism or not Zionism. I'm not interested in this. Israel, if it continues to be an ethnic settler colonialist state, it will not win the legitimacy of the world and of the Arab world and of the Palestinians. It should have a different model in hand, and I think this is for me the whole question. Now, ethnic cleansing for me is an inevitable result of a settler colonialist movement that for historical reasons decided that it had no other choice, and maybe in many ways, rightly so, some of them felt they had no other choice but to continue the colonialist project which Britain helped them to establish in Palestine, right? So if you continue to harbor these ideas, then ethnic cleansing is inevitable, not only in 1948, but also in 2015 and 2016. That's the danger, that the Nakba is not a closed chapter in the history of the Palestinians. It's an ongoing chapter. And this is the kind of thing that I think we have to find. I don't have magic formulas of how to do it, but all my life I'm seeking these formulas, how to engage with my own society and show them the mirror. When last time I tried to show them the mirror, they broke the mirror over my head. So I'm looking for other ways, but they have to look in the mirror. It won't help them. And they cannot hide behind the Holocaust and behind anti-Semitism, all these masks. Abuse the Holocaust memory, abuse the crime of anti-Semitism. It won't help them. It won't help them, and eventually the world will get tired of these kind of cloaks that they use to hide instead of boldly saying, we need to change, and it will be a painful change. There's no doubt. What can you do? I mean, it's some operations are not nice to save the patient. Now, you're right, the social networking and media. I think it played a very important role. I think it played, you're right. I think that the one thing the Israelis realized is that they cannot hide what goes on. But look what they're doing with the flotilla. They don't allow people to go through Ben-Gurion Airport to see with their own eyes what's going on. They don't allow reporters to roam freely to see what they're doing. Somehow they still believe, I don't understand the pathology there, but they somehow still believe that they can hide it. I think you're right. I mean, it's absurd to think in 2012 that you can hide from the world what goes on. Or that you can tell stories about the Mavi Marmara that everybody knows are not true. But they still believe in it. God knows why, but they do. And I think with time, this will hopefully have a positive impact on them. The idea that what they do is far more transparent than they think. Far more transparent. And that can be a very positive idea to continue exposing it. Now, there are two questions, one about the Arab dimension and the American dimension. I agree, I think the Arab dimension is very important, and in many ways I think it's not so much the Arab society's commitment to the Palestine cause which is the most important factor. It used to be. I think it's far more important, but that's my view, to look for the success of the democratization of the Arab world. I think the basic cartography of Israel is going to be seriously challenged in the next 10 years. What the Israelis were selling with a certain element of success, especially after 9/11, was that they are an island of democracy in a sea of barbarism. And I think what's happening is that the sea becomes more and more democratic, and the limelight is now on the island, and the island doesn't look very democratic anymore. And I think this is something that they will have to engage with. So I think that is important. But I think it's also true, and maybe you meant that as well, I think it's also very, very true, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I forgot to mention that in my lecture. Zionism is a movement that forced itself on the Arab world. Nobody invited the National Jewish Movement to build its home in the midst of the Arab world. Now, the Israelis have never, as a state and a society, never reconciled with this geographical location, which is also, of course, a cultural location, religious location, and a civilization location. So they have, as I always say, they have this dream that one day there will be an earthquake that will take them away from the Middle East and append them, I don't know, to Italy, or maybe better, to Norway. Now, I'm not a geologist, but I don't think such an earthquake is on the cards. And they behave like the thug in the neighborhood, and they are surprised that the neighborhood doesn't like them. And I think this alienation of the neighborhood and alienating the neighborhood, so to speak, is something the Israelis would have to come to terms with. They have to be part of the Arab world, and they have to be part of its problems and solutions. They had the chance. They brought 1 million Arab Jews to Israel. They had the chance of using that community, and they de-Arabized them. And they gave them the message that if you want to be part of the Jewish state, you have to be even more anti-Arab than the European Jews. So they missed the chance with this particular group of people. And that's a pity. That's a great pity, because this was something that could have changed the history of Israel and Palestine. But they decided knowingly that they don't want that to happen, and they will, and they are paying the price for this. And so I think this could happen. As for the American connection, you know, in this book, I have an article. Because I'm an historian, I don't like to accept that what you see in the last 10 years is what history offers you or the future offers you. I think it's very important to mention that American policy was not always anti-Palestinian, contrary to what people say. And because it was not always anti-Palestinian, we have some hopes that it can again be pro-Palestinian. I want to mention two historical junctures, which are very important to remember. When the Balfour Declaration was made, the American administration was, and especially President Wilson, was very annoyed with this idea that you can give something which doesn't belong to you to someone it doesn't belong to. And he suggested that one should ask the majority of the people of Palestine what kind of a state they want. Unfortunately, he fell ill in 1920, and America went into splendid isolation until Pearl Harbor. But this was the American policy against the colonialist powers, Britain and France. Second, we should mention the Eisenhower administration. Now, the Eisenhower administration had its follies in all kinds of things it did in the Arab world. But on the Palestine question, it was crystal clear. especially John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State. He came to Israel and he wrote to the president and said to President Eisenhower, I see no reason in the world why all the Palestinian refugees cannot come back home. All the Israelis' excuses seem to me feeble, he said, and unrealistic. We should pressure the Israeli government to allow the refugees to return. And he even suggested suspending a special loan to Israel on this basis. In fact, that prompted Abba Ibn, who was the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, to create AIPAC, because suddenly they realized that the American administration is very volatile. And they had this idea that you have to pressure the American administration. Kennedy was not better from an Israeli perspective. I'm not saying that the Israelis assassinated. No. I leave it to Oliver Stone to hint. But I don't think so. But it's very true, and you can see it in the documents, the Israelis were elated when LB Johnson was not elected but appointed. So there was, there were other chapters in the American relationship with the Palestine question, and there could be others. But I do agree that in the last 20 years, of course, this is something that the only thing you want to see is an end for American involvement rather than an extension of it. What I meant is that in the false paradigm, when people talked about Palestinians, they meant only the Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And when they talked about Palestine, they meant only the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Now, the Israelis are already included in any peace process. Now, of course, when I talk about, for instance, a one-state solution, I'm looking for a state with equal rights for everyone who lives between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean, regardless of their religion, ethnicity, or state. And I think that it's, I know the place, believe me, I lived there all my life. There is enough space for Palestinian refugees who want to return. There's enough place for Jews who want to come back. This is not a matter of capacity. This is a matter of ideology. If we as Jews would lead the way, because we have now the powerful hand, if you want, if we would lead the way and say, in a very evolutionary way, I'm not naive, there's 100 years of bloodshed, you have to do it carefully, you have to do it in a very responsible way. You don't just do it like this. But if we will build the way for a political outfit which would give equal representation for everyone, we would have done a great service not only for the Palestinians but also to ourselves. Now, the settlers, yes, I think the settlers are part of the wardens, but I think what, if you've seen the settlements, they are themselves gated communities. And when you put them on the map, they create a kind of invisible, sometimes visible, wall around Palestinian areas. So the settlements and the settlers are part of what I call the mega prison. Although I don't think all of them want to be in such a capacity, and of all of them would have liked that capacity. Now, you ask a very interesting question, why do settlers want to go and live with loaded guns and so on? I think we have to understand that half of what we call settlers are living in neighborhoods and urban areas where they don't need to carry any loaded guns. So not all the settlers are carrying loaded guns. In fact, half of the settlers, there are many Israeli researchers on this, half of the settlers don't regard themselves as settlers. The greater Jerusalem area, which is kind of an amoeba that keeps growing in Israel, it will swallow Vancouver if you're not dangerous, will be also part of greater Jerusalem in no time. The greater Jerusalem area is an urban sprawl that doesn't have people who carry guns, doesn't have people who think that ideologically they are there as settlers. They think that they are part of Israel, as most Israelis think that they are part of Israel. I think that's one of the success of various Israeli governments, to create this ambiguity between what is settlement or not. You are probably talking about the hardcore of the settlements, which are still in isolated area in the midst of Palestinian areas. You know, I don't know if you've been in the army. I was in the army. Loaded guns are very dangerous. They can mesmerize you. They can mesmerize a Palestinian freedom fighter. They can mesmerize a young Israeli soldier, and they can mesmerize an Israeli Jewish settler. Guns, not far away from here, you have a society that, you know, adores gun culture. So it's not nothing Jewish about it. Yes, carrying gun can give you all kinds of sublimation and sometimes replacement if you have nothing else. I don't want to go into it. You don't look young. You look too young to explore that avenue. But yes, it's. I'm not surprised. I really, because I know the feeling as a soldier. I know the feeling. So that's not something that you can easily dismantle. I think what you have to dismantle is a mentality of siege. A mentality of war. I think you have every Israeli Jew who goes through the educational system is being given a doctrine that very few of us have decided to challenge. And that doctrine says, unfortunately, this area wants to destroy us. The people around us are our sworn enemies. So we have two chances, two options, either to leave or to stay, but living in an abnormal way, where you need a strong army, when you need everyone to be part of the army, where you have to protect yourself with your gun and so on. For Israeli Jews, this is not something unreasonable. And it doesn't mean that they all like it, but they accept it as kind of a necessity. I think they're wrong. I think that the best weapon is to offer what I had tonight was offering, and I think you won't need all these means. But this is the mentality. It's a militaristic mentality that relies on this ethnic ideology. Now, Iran. I think the dissent is interesting between the chief of the security services and the trio that wants to take Israel to war, the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, the foreign minister Lieberman, and the defense minister Barak. So it's very encouraging in a way that the Israeli security establishment, first of all, doesn't want a war with Iran. That's good news. Although I always remind myself that in 1982, that same military establishment said to Menachem Begin that it would be a terrible mistake to invade Lebanon. And they invaded Lebanon. So the fact that the military apparatus is against it doesn't, unfortunately, does not ensure that this will not happen. Far more interesting, I think, for our case tonight is what the former head of the Shabak said about Israel's treatment of Palestinians in general. I don't know if you saw that. He said, we treated them as a racist nation, unjustly and undemocratically. Now, I don't know exactly how to digest such a thing for someone who was heading the apparatus that did all these things. If it had been as part of the new Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Israel, I would have, of course, felt very good about it, but it's not part. On the other end, who knows? Who knows? Maybe something is moving even up there. Who knows? I do believe people are decent, whether they're Jews or Arabs, whether they're Israelis and Palestinians. And I think sometimes this decency, I hope always, this decency will come out. Eventually, I hope so, that they would understand it. But time will tell. This is an exception that so far doesn't prove the rule. Now, about the flotilla and so on, I'm very careful about it. I respect every initiative that wants to break a siege, that wants to encourage people, empower people, and so on. So I will say it in the following way. I think the impact of the flotilla, you all know what the flotilla is, right? Yeah. No? The flotilla was an attempt by Europe, mainly European and American, North American activists to fly through Israeli airport and to go to the West Bank to show solidarity with the occupied people. And Israel blocked that attempt twice with the collaboration of the airliners that were supposed to fly these people. Now, the effect in Israel itself was minimal. I think most Israelis felt that the government was absolutely right in not allowing the people to come. They don't believe that these are people with good intentions. So one should assess the importance of such messages. I'm not sure that this was the purpose, to change the Israeli public opinion. If this was the purpose, it's not a very good tactic. If the purpose is to give the Palestinians in the West Bank a hope that they are not alone and someone is interested in them and so on, that's a very good purpose, and it worked. But as a kind of a game changer with inside Israel, it's not the way to do it. I don't think that's what's going to make. I think the two drastic actions from and pressure from the outside and building a new kind of education from the inside are the only thing that will really change their perspectives and mentality. I'm sure there are more than just the Canadian examples. There are many other examples for people sharing or finding reasonable solutions for national identities within a mega national identity. I mean, after all the nation states in the world are not made of one nation group. And of course, this could be shown in many ways. Although I don't think the 21st century needs national solutions. I think it needs a national solution. I never understood the attraction of nationalism, I must say. Who wants to be with... who wants to be with his relatives the whole year round? I mean, you can see them on Christmas or Hanukkah or I don't know what, but you want to be with them all the time? This must be sickening. But there you have another European invention that we all cherish as if there's some great wisdom in it. But if people want to be nationalists, we'll have a bi-national state. I mean, I won't leave Israel because of it. It's much better than what we have now. So, and it's much better than a two-state solution. So I have nothing against it. But I think what I keep reminding myself, I keep remembering a letter that Mahatma Gandhi wrote to Martin Buber. I think sort of feels the essence of this. Buber was very angry with Gandhi for not supporting Zionism. So Gandhi wrote back to him, and by the way, and this is why there's no street named after Gandhi in Israel. We punished him. There's no Gandhi Avenue. We showed him. And he wrote to Buber that, you know, I understand the wish to live next to the Palestinians. I don't understand the wish to live instead of the Palestinians. And as long as that's what you want to do, I will not support you. So I think this is the model that we should look for. So however it will be formulated eventually. 10 years without a peaceful solution is very much of the same, but much worse. I mean, we know how Israel and Palestine develops. It's incremental. It's getting worse, but not in a dramatic way. That's why the main media attention is very hard to catch on this. It's a daily occurrence. This is not big dramas apart from events such as Gaza, and that's why they don't focus on it, not just because they're sometimes afraid to do it, but because it's not big news, two Palestinian prisoners dying out of hunger, five Palestinians being expelled, two Palestinian houses being demolished. Newspapers cannot accumulate things that happen on a daily basis and present a 10-year kind of criminality. And I think we'll have another 10 years of criminality. But of course, nothing is frozen. The Palestinians may uprise. The Arab world may show a very different attitude towards what's going on in Palestine. Who knows, even the Western, one or two Western governments will begin to change their attitudes more dramatically towards Israel. So without peace, I think there will be more bloodshed, more oppression, but also more severe opposition to that oppression. So it's much better to think that there is a way forward. Why I left Israel, and I didn't understand how it's connected to Norman Finkelstein. We didn't leave together, Israel. We don't live together either. I don't understand. Or maybe you meant what happened to us? Where is the guy who asked? Oh, I see, yeah. No, I think professional academics in Israel and in the United States who dare to challenge the hegemonic paradigms were definitely treated in a way that is familiar to us from the medieval times, where when the message was not nice, you killed the messenger instead of encountering the message. I paid for this with my job in Haifa University. He paid for this with his job in DePaul University. and we both are wandering around the world looking for positions. But I think the situation is far better. You mentioned the social network. The Western academia has changed dramatically. This is not the Western academia of 10 years ago. I think you can see the attempt of Israel to build Center for Israel Studies all over the place, injecting millions of money into what they call the war over the campuses, because they've lost the campuses. They've lost the campuses. And this is the erosion of the Israeli moral pillar, what they call the war of legitimization. And the only people who can give them legitimization, contrary to what they thought for many, many years, are the Palestinians. For many years, Israelis said, oh, it doesn't matter what the Arabs think or the Muslims think or the Palestinians think. We have legitimization from the United Nations, from Europe, from the United States. And they discovered that this is not enough. When you victimize someone, only the victims can legitimize you. And the victims have, that's the only powerful asset they still have in an otherwise an imbalanced kind of relationship. So I think it's important to remember this. I didn't put in one boat Chomsky and Finkelstein and Uri Avneri. I said that unfortunately people whom I admire, who are my mentors in many ways, are supporting the false paradigm. Of course, I said it in my talk, they support it for different reasons that the Israeli government supports it. But in the end of the day, if you support a two-state solution, it means that you ignore 80% of Palestine, and you ignore half of the Palestinians, even if you are the Pope himself. So I think this is a valid and an important argument, and I'm very glad Norm and I, it was his initiative. We wrote this book because we think that this is an important debate. He hasn't changed his mind, although I'm confident that in the next edition he will, he will change his mind. But we wrote this in order to show that despite of the dissent, we are part of the same solidarity movement with the Palestinians. But that doesn't mean I should be silent when I think that this is a false paradigm. I'm sorry. I mean, Norman Finkelstein is such a persuasive speaker that he persuaded himself about the false paradigm. But he did not persuade me. Now, when I say a false paradigm, it doesn't mean that I think that the people who support it are not moral, are not logical, are better or worse. I'm just saying I want them to join me and my friends, and I'm not alone, as you know, and many more and more people join us in pushing towards the creation of one state over Israel and Palestine. I think this is the future for me as an Israeli who lives there, for Mahmoud Yazbek, my friend in Nazareth, for people who are refugees who live in Canada. I think that is the best solution, and I think the two-state solution is taking us away from life of justice, reconciliation, and peace. And I will argue even with my father and sister and brother and with my best friends and mentors on this. And this is what I'm doing. And I'm very glad that we found a very civilized way of doing it because we believe that this is an important debate. At least one thing has happened. If you remember, 15 years ago, people who supported the one-state solution were treated either as lunatics or at best as lunatics and at worst as people who work for some subversive organizations. This debate is legitimate now. It's a legitimate debate. And it's very difficult to argue today that the two-state solution is working, that there is a two-state solution around the corner, or that there's something terribly wrong with someone who has a vision for a democracy that would benefit all those who live there and all those who used to live there. You know, I always liked the Israeli consul general in New York, Alon Pinkas, the former one, who said in a public debate with me, this is a dangerous man, and he meant it. He wants a democracy in Israel and Palestine. I'm willing to be this dangerous man in the next 10 years. Thank you.